Here we are, February 15th, 2009. Oh my goodness, I wrote 2008. I am only 55 years old now. Because, you know, you gain a year every time it goes past January 1st. That's what the insurance companies say. So it doesn't matter when your birthday is. It just matters what the year is. February 15th, 2009, lecture discussion number 80 on Genesis 1 through 19, which of course means that we have had 80 successive lectures in a row, or 79 that leads to today, all of them tied perfectly in with the ones before. Why are you laughing? And so, if you have been here for all 80, then what can I say about you other than Bill's postulate of a few weeks ago? Which, for those of you who weren't here, Bill postulated, was I weird before I came to Cliffside, or did Cliffside make me weird? All right. Probably necessary now to recap and review a bit this morning, being that many items are on the table. There are many items on the table. In fact, today they're strewn about, and we're not going to get to any of them today. That's how this will fit so well. To those of that I consider unenlightened, that's not true. But to the unenlightened, it would seem to be a disorganized mess, a disordered state, confusion, wreckage, perhaps. But to those of us who are adept at managing multi-levels of detail, we see not slovenly heaps of information. What we see is a system. Okay, what I see is a system. I'm trying to include others, but I see a system. Occasionally, however, I realize it's required to explain, or to re-explain, actually, my network or my schematic to the fastidious among us, the list makers, the methodized, the persnickety. So I'm going to begin this morning for those of them that may be wondering what exactly is the direction that connects 79 to 80, or to 78 or 76, the last few lectures. That, by the way, would number about 90% of you at some level, but I'm going to try to put it all together for you again today, as best I can, so that you'll understand how they fit. Where have we been recently? Well, we have been in Genesis 15, and we have stopped, if you wish. We have come to a place where we are stopped, and it is the two birds that are undivided. We got through the heifer, the goat, the ram reasonably quickly, and we stopped at the two birds. And there is a very good reason for that. They are the two in that ritual, in that ceremony, that God did not cut in half. He said, leave them undivided. And so the big question of Genesis 15 is, why are those two birds undivided? Well, that sends us to Leviticus 14, which is the two-bird ritual for the cleansing of the healed leper, which, as you know, is a shock, because there should be no such thing as a healed leper. There has never been a healed leper except for 2 Kings 5 in all of Israel until Christ came and healed thousands of them, multitudes of them. If you got leprosy, you died. You weren't ever healed. You were dead. So the fact that there is, hidden in Leviticus 14, this two-bird ritual for the cleansing of the healed leper is our first clue as to why the two birds are not undivided in Genesis 15. Hopefully, that makes sense to you. As soon as we find out we have a healed leper, though, we have one healed leper. Luke 4:27 tells us. That's Naaman, the Syrian commander in the Jordan River. He's cleansed of his leprosy. So we got to go from Genesis 15 to Leviticus 14 to 2 Kings 5. So far, so good. Some of you are laughing at me again. I'm very sensitive. Well, I am. Thank you for being sympathetic to my sensitivity. You're supposed to laugh when I'm making you laugh, not just arbitrarily. Okay. After Naaman the Syrian, the next place we go trying to figure out the leprous or the leprosy ritual or the two birds undivided is 2 Kings 6, the floating of the iron axe head that was lost in the Jordan River. And I have posited, as you know, that that is the exact same spot that Naaman, of course, was healed when he was dipped 7 times in the Jordan River. So those are the same. And then after that, we have Joshua 3, 4, and 5, where the ark crosses the Jordan River. And I again say that that is exactly the same place that Naaman is at. And I'll make that case in just a second. The exact same place where the axe head was floated up. And the Joshua 3, 4, and 5 now add circumcision, because it is the uncircumcised second generation of Israel crossing the Jordan River with the ark in that spot. The ark in the mist and the Jordan River heaped up at Adam. And that symbolism comes to play. And all of that brought us to the 2 12 stone memorial towers that are forever. Now, that's how we get to where we are today. That's not all of it, but it's enough to present at least the path that we've taken. I hope you see that we just kind of work our way along. But all of it is to do what? Thank you for participating. All of it is to try to understand why the two birds are undivided in Genesis 15. And I believe, as you know, if you've been here, that Genesis 15 is the preeminent chapter of the Old Testament. So it requires the most work, but it also has the most extraordinary wisdom in it, in my view. And hopefully all of you have made silently the connections that link each of those stops that I just reiterated along the path. For example, remembering why Naaman connects to the Jordan River crossing. It's because the Jordan River crossing was in the same spot that Naaman was dipped. How do I know that? I get asked that all the time. And I really want you to go check that out. I want you to say, how come he keeps saying that and never backs it up? Because if you'd go research, you'd find out what my backup is. My backup is Matthew 3:16. What's Matthew 3:16? That is the baptism of Christ. That is God himself in the flesh being baptized. Does he need to be baptized? He's God. He has no sin. He is put in the same spot, I propose, as the ark. How do I know that? Because John the Baptist says very clearly in the Gospels that John the Baptist baptized at the place of the crossing. What crossing? The ark crossing. He put Christ in the exact spot of the ark crossing. It says so. The word means the place of the crossing where he baptizes. Okay? Another connection. Why circumcision? Or how does circumcision connect to the floating of the lost iron axe head? How does the sign of the 12 stones connect to the two birds? I have 2 12 stone towers, one at Gilgal, one in the midst of the Jordan River, at the place of the crossing, at the place that Christ was baptized. How does that connect to communion? What's that got to do with anything? How did I get communion? Why did I do that? Why did I throw communion in there? I just thought I would, again. But I wanted to see if anyone had considered that. See, communion is really two things. It is the blood and the flesh, or the cup and the bread. The cup is a symbol for the blood of Christ. The bread is a symbol of the body of Christ. That's why the bread must be unleavened. And what I mean by that is it must not have yeast in it. It must not have leaven in it. It must be unleavened. It must be a wafer. Those of you who, and we were taught one time, Bill and I, no, Bill was there. We were taught one time at a meeting that you could use a Twinkie and a Coca-Cola for communion service. Isn't that right? Can't remember that guy's name. And I didn't really want to get into it with him because he was so adamant that it didn't matter. It does matter. That's another sermon. The bread is a memorial. He says so. Take, eat this in remembrance. It's a memorial. So what are the stones? They're a memorial. I'm tying the stone memorial to the bread memorial and the cup memorial. The cup is the new covenant. What are we to remember with the cup and the bread? What is the new covenant? And then, of course, now the greatest relationship in all of the New Testament between two ordinances is what? Come on. You can do this. What is... Very good. Very good question. Are you buying time? You're trying to get me to... We have two ordinances in the New Testament. What are they? Baptism, yes. Those of you who are Baptists should have said baptism. What's the other one? Communion. What is the relationship between baptism and communion? Is they're memorials in some way. They're remembrances in some way. What is the relationship between them and the two stone towers? Right off the bat, you know that Christ was put in the same spot as one of those two stone towers. He dictated that. That's where he wanted to go. He directed John the Baptist to put him at the place of that crossing and named that place the place of that crossing. So, obvious question, what is the relationship between communion and baptism? And what is the relationship then between the two stone memorial towers, one at Gilgal and one in the Jordan River, of the Ark crossing? How does that fit with the Iron Axe Head? How does that fit to Naaman? And off we go, right? Anyway, I hope you notice the pattern of things in Scripture like this. As an aside, as a by the way, it intrigues me to hear constantly how the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, are four perspectives with four purposes that form a whole. You hear that all the time. If you want to figure out what happened, you have to put all the Gospels side by side. Each one has a particular focus. Matthew focuses on this particular aspect. John will focus on that particular aspect. You put the two of them together, you will find the whole or the totality of what happened. I always hear that. It is absolutely the case. No one will ever dispute that. They jump up and down and tell you all the time. And good for them. They should. In other words, the four Gospels must be read side by side. Each one has information that the others don't necessarily have. Some have the same information, but there's always a whole there. None singularly is complete. They must be all added together to get a whole. Yet when this principle is likewise applied to the Old Testament, what do I get? Great resistance. No, they tell me, you can't do that. You can't do what we do in the New Testament with the Old Testament. What's my response? Same author. I mean, it's the same. 2 Kings 6 does not stand apart from Joshua 3 and 4. Anyway, back on task. I have to focus. No ranting. Stay calm. More breathing. Obviously, the central theme in my disorganized pile mess, if you will, my great pile of stuff, the central theme for the last few weeks and today is, because of the two birds, is we are talking about memorials. The theme, therefore, is testifying. The two bird undivided, they testify. The two bird cleansing ritual testifies. The two mule loads of dirt that Naaman takes back is testifying, is evidence. Communion and baptism testify. Circumcision testifies. The axe head and the branch that's thrown in to float the axe head testifies. The Ark of the Covenant testifies. Witness, testimonial, evidence. Can't repeat that enough. Evidence. Let me say it again. Evidence. If I told you we are talking about evidence, what are we talking about? Yes, we're talking about the courtroom, says the attorney. Evidence is a courtroom. Once again, we're in a courtroom. We're in a legal procedure. We are in a trial. We have a judge and we have a jury. Those of you who don't think we have a jury, Matthew 12:41-42 tells you that the Queen of Sheba will be in the jury. It will say to you the generation of Nineveh will be in the jury. Revelation 7:9, Revelation 19:14, Jude 14, we will judge, be part of the judge system in the sense that we are in the jury. So once again, we are looking at evidence. This is evidence. Evidence being presented in a trial, in a courtroom, in front of a judge. There, therefore, is a defendant, isn't there? What is the case? What is the sentence? What are the consequences of being found guilty? Ultimately, has to be discussed. The obvious question, of course, as I just said, is what evidence is being presented? What exactly is it being said? What is the witnesses saying specifically? And that's what we're trying to resolve. That's why we're here today, trying to figure it all out. I do kind of liken Sunday service, kind of, sort of, to a snow machine pulling a huge inner tube in a circle. You ever see that done on a lake? You've seen that, right? And people do what? There's a guy with a snow machine. He's got the hottest snow machine in the world. He's got a 50-foot rope, and he's got a big, massive tractor tire inner tube back there. And what do people do? They jump on the inner tube. What, are they crazy? Why did they do that? And then, of course, on the lake is what? Little berms everywhere. So he gets to spinning around and around, and he whirls the inner tube around, and they hit the berm, Again, I liken Sunday morning service to a guy with a snow machine pulling in a tube with people who have climbed over onto it. And people fly off every direction. Broken bones, screaming. Children, I know, children crying. Dogs barking. Hypothermia. And drowning. That's kind of how I see Sunday morning. The same way, Cliffside Community Chapel. Yeah, that's right. First, you got to get them on a tube. You don't tell them that you're going to make them dizzy and spin around and bloody them up. Otherwise, but they do. They just naturally jump on it by themselves. And pretty much, like I said, sums it up here. I speak analogously, of course. The snow machine inner tube is a symbol. Okay. Never mind. Two stone tablets, blood and flesh, two stone tower memorials, two undivided birds, two bird cleansing ritual. Note that I am talking over and over again about two. Two that testify. Two is the number of witness, of evidence, of a trial occurring in Scripture. Immediately when I say two that testify, two that witness, you say back to me, two witnesses. Two witnesses of Revelation chapter 11, Zechariah 4, 2 through 14. Those are the passages that have the two witnesses. The capstone of, if you will, of the two witnesses or the two testimony or the evidence issue. I have two men that come down to this earth that are sent, that are the lamps and the olive trees of Christ. His, he calls them mine. My witnesses will come down and they will produce and present evidence and will testify to the world. Now, many will say they aren't the capstone. They will say Israel and the church are the capstone, are saved, the saved, the believers and the angels are, or the law and the prophets, or the Old and the New Testament are law and grace. They will have all kinds of two that are witnesses. But I'll just tell you, that most think the two witnesses that preach, that prophesize, that declare truth, that have the power to shut heaven off so that no rain falls in the days of their prophecy, they have the power to turn water into blood. Where's that happened before? Egypt, that would be a partial good answer. Where's the great answer? The wedding, the first sign that Christ used. He turned water into wine, wine a symbol for blood, or water into blood. and he put it into, I believe, cracked clay vessels, and he had servants pouring water into busted vessels, and they're going, what are we doing this for? And all of a sudden, everything is put together, and it's wonderful wine. Anyway, that's another sermon, too. But I have two witnesses in Revelation 11 that come with fire and come with plagues, which is why everyone asks the obvious question about them. Why are they called witnesses? If I got witnesses, as I said, I got a court hearing, I got a trial, I got a judge, I got a jury. I have something else. Why do I have a trial? Yeah, something's been wrong. What do we call it? A crime. I have a crime that has occurred. What is the crime that requires all this testimony? Both very good answers. Can you separate death from sin or murder from sin? No. A's for you. An A and an A. Thank you for doing that. But I have a crime. What is the crime? If it is murder, who got murdered? Okay? Where's the crime? When did it happen? When's the trial? Where's the trial? Who's calling this trial? Who's in authority over it? Who's asking them to testify? And whom are they testifying against? And who are these two witnesses? By the way, what's the number one view, these two witnesses? Moses and Elijah. Very good. Some say Moses and Aaron. Moses and Aaron's very important if you have that view, because that's where we're headed today. Some would say Enoch and Elijah. The case is strongest, I believe, that these two witnesses, some will say they haven't yet been determined. I think the case is strongest that these two are Moses and Elijah. Jewish tradition says so. Jewish tradition says Moses and Elijah will come back, both. You're probably familiar with Elijah in Passover, also says Moses. Then we have the Transfiguration. We have the Assumption of Moses. We have Elijah's Ascension, all of that. Is the stronger case, I believe, that these two witnesses, Revelation 11, Zechariah 4, are Moses and Elijah. Some disagree. They're what? Thank you. In any event, the obvious questions must be dealt with. And believe it or not, we are dealing with the obvious questions today. I know it doesn't seem like it, but we really are. Any discussion of Moses as one of the two witnesses of Revelation 11 will eventually include Aaron and Miriam, Numbers 12. So we're back to Numbers 12. Miriam turning leprous as Gehazi turns leprous in 2 Kings 5. So here comes the inner tube again, swinging around. Wave as you go by. It's going to make you dizzy. I know that. I know what this does. Every time you think you make progress, you all of a sudden have to go back. Don't eat before you come here. Wait for the buffet, because my goal is to... Do we have ham today? Do we? Okay. Last week we had everything that went with ham. Everything. We had all kinds of everything. But we did not have the ham. No ham for you. I worked on that joke for 6 pages. It meant nothing to anybody but a couple of people. It was an inside joke. Anyway, this is the time and the place in the lecture series to divert. You would think I would finish Joshua 4 and 5, but I can't. I've got to stop right here and insert Numbers 12. And it's been a long time. It's back in November, I think, where we got into Numbers 12, where I started it. And believe it or not, this is the natural progression. You think I'm crazy, don't you? I don't blame you, but really, this is how you do it. Go take the class someday. You'll say, wow, he really is following that pattern, isn't he? But we should reread it. It's been a long time. So here we go, really fast. Then Miriam and Aaron. The reason we're here is because of the hand sign of Moses. When he puts his hand in, he brings his hand out, puts it in, takes it out. It's leprous or it's not. That's one of the signs he takes to the nation of Israel. Leprosy takes you to the two birds. Two birds takes you to Leviticus 14. Leviticus 14 takes you to Naaman. Naaman takes you to Gehazi. Gehazi takes you over into the New Testament where I have the 10 lepers. And then this brings us all the way back to Miriam, who becomes just like Gehazi. Okay, you're all with me there? Here we go. Then Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Ethiopian woman whom he had married. Miriam and Aaron decide to speak against Moses because he's got an Ethiopian woman that he married. What's the obvious question there? Yeah, what's this Ethiopian woman doing to Miriam and Aaron? Why don't they like her? Seems like a pretty nice lady to me. She's Ethiopian. So what's the problem? So they said, has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also? Is it just Moses? Or is it us? And the Lord heard it. Now, the man Moses was very humble, more than all men who were on the face of the earth. When we read that before, I said, who wrote that? Moses did. Let me put it this way. Steve is the most humble of all people who have ever lived on all the face of the earth. Do you apply the humility to that? Maybe not, but it is true. Now the man Moses was very humble, more than all men who were on the face of the earth. Suddenly, don't pass over that, highlight that. Suddenly the Lord said to Moses, Aaron and Miriam, come out, you three, to the tabernacle of meeting. Bang. So the three came out. Then the Lord came down in a pillar of cloud and stood in the door of the tabernacle and called Aaron and Miriam, and they both went forward. Then he said, hear now my words, if there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision. I speak to him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. Those other prophets, they'll get a vision, they'll get a dream. Not Moses. It is kind of funny. God has a sense of humor. He is faithful in all my house. I speak with him face to face, even plainly, not in dark sayings. And he sees the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses? So the anger of the Lord was aroused against them, and he departed. Wow, he departs. What do you got to do now, Bible student? You gotta go find every place in the Old Testament and the New Testament where God departs. Where's the first place? Ezekiel 10, there you go. And when the cloud departed from above the tabernacle, suddenly Miriam became leprous, as white as snow, just like Gehazi, just like Moses' sign. Then Aaron turned towards Miriam, and there she was, a leper. What happens to lepers? They die. No one ever heals a leper, except who? God himself. So God just turned her leprous. We in big heebum wampum trouble. Yes. Absolutely does. Leviticus 13:13. Very good. 13:44. Got to solve that. Are we going to do it today? No. We save it. But it's on the list. It's right here. Explain Leviticus 13:13. Watch how fast we go over it. Then Aaron turned towards Miriam, and there she was, a leper. So Aaron said to Moses, oh, my Lord, Please do not lay this sin on us in which we have done foolishly and in which we have sinned. Please do not let her be as one dead whose flesh is half consumed when she comes out of her mother's womb. So Moses cried out to the Lord saying, please heal her, O God, I pray. Then the Lord said to Moses, if her father had but spit in her face, would she not be shamed 7 days? Let her be shut out of the camp 7 days, and afterwards she may be received again. So Miriam was shut out of the camp 7 days, and the people did not journey until Miriam was brought in again. And afterwards, the people moved from Hazeroth and camped in the wilderness of Paran. Now, hopefully you guys remember this passage. Like I said, it came up in November, I believe, and we asked the obvious questions then. First obvious question we ask is, why didn't Aaron turn leprous? How come only Miriam got this? Isn't Aaron just as guilty as she is? How come we always clobber Miriam? It's not fair. Is it fair, by the way, that only Miriam gets taken out? It absolutely is fair. If you ever think when you're reading Scripture that something's not fair, you have made a serious error. It's absolutely fair. But why? The question becomes why. And then Teresa's question. Explain Leviticus 13:13. Don't turn there. We're going right by it because Teresa asked it. But that's a very important question. Why unclean for 7 days? Why does she have to be outside the camp? That may seem obvious to you, but why 7 days? Why not 3 days? Why not 14 days? Why not 10 days? Why not 30 days? Why 7 days? What's the importance of seven? What is the relationship between Miriam and Gehazi and the sign of Moses' leprous hand? All three of them white as snow. All three of them suddenly. What is the meaning of this incredible phrase here? Father had but spit in her face. If her father had but spit in her face. What is the significance of the departing of the pillar of cloud? And as soon as it leaves, what happens? Sudden leprosy. What is the meaning or the reason the nation of Israel did not move? Why not leave her behind? Send something back for her. As soon as you're healed, get on the wagon, come find us. They don't move. Stand still until Miriam is healed and able to come back in. In other words, the nation of Israel did not move until Miriam was restored to it. What then, if any, is the relationship of Miriam to who in the New Testament? Here's an advanced question. I have what is called in the Old Testament the restoration of Miriam. I have what is called in the New Testament the restoration of? I do have in the New Testament the restoration of Israel. Let me reword it. I have in the Old Testament the restoration of Miriam in Numbers 12. In the New Testament, in the Gospels, I have the restoration of somebody else. Who? Peter. Absolutely, I do. What is the relationship then to Miriam and Peter? Is John 21 the restoration of Peter, the New Testament complement to Numbers 12? And I will say what? Yes, it is. So how so? How exactly does the answer of God, which is Numbers 12, 6 through 8, fit against the questions of Miriam and Aaron? Because they ask, has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also? God answers that question, both of those questions. How exactly does that answer fit those questions? What is the answer to the question that God asks? Why then were you not afraid? What is the purpose of inserting of Numbers 12:3, this humility of Moses? Why is that there? Why does Aaron turn to Moses? He turns to Moses immediately, as if what? As if, yeah, one, you could fix it, or two, you caused it. Is Aaron blaming Moses here? Look at what he says. So Aaron said to Moses, oh, my Lord, please do not lay this sin on us. Who's he talking to? Who's the Lord in that sentence? Moses, don't do this to us. How is this Moses' fault? Why is it that Aaron thinks it's Moses' fault? Is he blaming Moses? Because Moses got to intercede? Well, yes is the answer. But humanly, does Moses have to intercede? They're trying to do what to Moses? They're trying to get him killed. We'll get to that next week. They're trying to get him out of there. We don't need Moses. We got me and you. Let's get rid of Moses. God speaks to us. We can run the place. So much for Moses. Now, all of a sudden, one of you is dying. You go to the guy you're trying to kill and say, save her. It's your fault. That makes sense? Welcome to human nature, huh? Why does Moses cry out then to save Miriam? Why does he do it? Why not just let her die in her leprosy? That's your fault, lady. Look, this is what you get. What goes around comes around. Karma. Why not just do it? Down goes Miriam. Okay, toe the line, Aaron. He doesn't. He cries out to save her. Why does he do that? We have a clue. Now, this man, Moses, was very humble. More than anybody. Why this order? This is this extraordinary order that is in this area of Numbers. The rejection of manna, then the 70 elders, Eldad and Medad, the sending of the quail, which results in death, Miriam and Aaron, and then what comes after them is the spies sent into Canaan. That is a precise order that when you put it all together, you understand what's going on with Miriam and Aaron. They naturally must be right after the quail and right before the spies go into Canaan. And then finally, what I think, or not finally yet, define anger. So the anger of the Lord was aroused. You have to define anger. Isn't God mad like we're mad? No, He's not. His anger is not sinful. It is righteous. It is honored. Same thing in Exodus 4:14. Do not ever think. Do not anthropomorphize. Do not put your anger and your personality on God. It is incorrect to do so. It is blasphemy to do so. He does not get angry like we get angry. People will read this all the time and they say, oh, look at God. He's just this little 2-year-old throwing a tantrum. If you say that, that's anthropomorphizing Him. He does not have that in Him. That's putting sin inside of God. Don't do it. Blasphemy. Heresy. Finally, the final question. If Naaman equals Joshua 4 and 5, and Miriam equals Gehazi, how does Miriam fit with Joshua 4 and 5? And answering that is why we will be returning pretty quickly to the 12 stone signs. Why does snow, leprosy, is a sign? And Miriam is to be remembered. Israel is said to, they are commanded to remember what happened to Miriam, Deuteronomy 24:9. Okay, we're going to answer one question out of all of those. Those are the easy questions or the obvious questions. We're going to answer the easiest one of those. And the easiest one of those is, then the Lord said to Moses, if her father had but spit in her face. That's the easiest one. So when your kids tonight say, Mommy, Daddy, could you read to us out of the Bible? And you read Numbers 12. Should be great. And they say, what is this spit in the face thing? You're going to go, well, nice that you asked that. That happens to be the easiest one of all of those. It's really quite difficult. Sorry. Not really. Fake sorry, yes. It's quite difficult, actually. They're all quite difficult. Spitting in the face and removing sandals are tied together. Who, by the way, do you think of when you say remove sandals? You think of spitting in the face, because spitting in the face and removing sandals are the same. But you think Moses had to take his sandals off and Joshua had to take his sandals off. Okay, so now you're into taking sandals off. And both Moses can't, I've ignored you already today. That's, yeah. If you're talking about John and the washing of the feet. Oh, You're talking about the anointing. Huh, interesting question. Not for the same reasons that Moses and Joshua did. They were taking their feet, their sandals off because of hallowed ground. And as an aside, Moses had the in Exodus when he is caught by God to be killed, and Joshua has a similar experience with the commander and the sword. Both of those are Christ. So we have this tremendous tie between Moses and Joshua. Anyway, spitting in the face, removing sandals, leads you to the blotting out of the name of the dead brother. Are you familiar with that? If I have a in Jewishness, in the Hebrew, in the culture of the Jews, if I have a, and you see it, Lori was watching the show on one of the Hallmark things the other day. I happened to watch it and said, oh, cool, that's Numbers 12. If I have a dead brother, then the living brother, in order to keep the name of the dead brother from being blotted out, must take his wife and produce an heir. And that heir is assigned to the dead brother. Now, if the living brother refuses to honor his dead brother, he goes in front of a group of Jewish elders, and the woman that he refuses to have the child of her dead husband with in order to honor his dead brother will take her sandal off and hit him with it and spit in his face. Okay? Now, you have seen recently people throwing shoes, right? That is in the Mideast culture, but in Jewishness, it's specifically regarding the dead brother and the living brother. If the living brother refuses to honor his dead brother, then his face is spit in and his sandal is thrown at him. And it's quite complicated indeed and fascinating and something we should study. It makes for a wonderful movie, and we can't answer any more questions because we're almost out of time and we're not going to do it today. Because we're going to work on this if the father had but spit in her face. Suffice to say for today, understand the spitting in the face has a marriage context, has a living brother, a dead brother, the blotting out and the heir in context, and it is brings great disgrace on the one whom has the sandal and the spit directed at them. Great disgrace. Miriam then has brought great disgrace on herself. That's what God's saying. She has greatly disgraced herself by what she has done. What has she done? She's asked two questions. Suddenly, God comes. So, what do we think then? This is where the application comes. Have you asked those two questions today? Have you brought great disgrace on yourself today? What do you think? Yeah, those of you who have been around yourselves for a while immediately go, oh, crud. What is this? Am I doing it? Honestly, I will tell you, I don't think you're doing it. If you are doing it, who's in trouble? Me. We'll explain in a second. God the Father must respond. Miriam has greatly disgraced herself. God the Father, God must spit in her face for what she has done. And it must be shown and it must be known. All of the people will know the disgrace of Miriam and none of them will move until she's restored. So obviously, who also disgraced himself? No, not really. He didn't turn leprous. What's the difference? You learn something, by the way, when you start to reread it. I'm going to say to you, Peter greatly disgraced himself. And which is why the next logical order after the disgrace of Miriam is the spies entering Canaan. And by the way, how'd those spies do? Not good. They went in and said, we can't take this land. We got all these problems. Those guys are huge. We got no chance. Let's run. Mail it in. The sign of Miriam, the disgrace of Miriam, the spitting into the face of Miriam did not affect the spies at all. After they waited 7 days, Didn't affect them. So how exactly had Miriam disgraced herself? Okay, we collect all the pieces. That's what we do. What pieces are we going to collect? We're going to collect 2 Kings 5 through 20, because Miriam must be connected to Naaman, right? Must be connected to Gehazi. And she, of course, is, because they have the same condition as a result. Gehazi, then, must disgrace himself the same way that Miriam did. Okay, 2 Kings 5:20. But Gehazi, the servant of Elijah, the man of God, said, "Look, my master has spared." Said, "Look, my master has spared Naaman the Syrian, while not receiving from the hands what he brought. But as the Lord lives, I will run after him and take something from him." Now 5:26-25. Now he went in and stood before his master Elisha and said to him. Now he went in and stood before his master. Elisha said to him, "Where did you go, Gehazi?" And he said, Gehazi answered, "Your servant did not go anywhere. He disgraced himself and was turned white." The father spit in his face there. Acts 5. Ananias and Sapphira struck dead because they disgraced themselves. The issue is clearly Gehazi thinking that his act was secret, isn't it? He thought he could get away with it. He thought it wouldn't matter that he chases after Naaman. Same thing true with Ananias and Sapphira, same as Aaron and Miriam. John 21, where Peter is there, it is the restoration of Peter is based on finally getting him to answer. It has nothing to do with what kind of love it is. The love is interchangeable. It has nothing to do with that. In spite of all the sermons you hear about that, those sermons are absolutely, totally wrong and without merit. Sorry. Not really. Fake sorry. The restoration of Peter is on the basis of his declaration. Finally, he answers, "You know all things," to Christ. "Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me?" The answer to that is, "You know all things." The restoration of Peter on the basis of the declaration of the omniscience of Jesus Christ. Same as Miriam. What's the key phrase? "The Lord heard it." When they were talking, the Lord heard it. And why were you not afraid? The disgrace of Miriam is her denial of the omniscience of God, of Jesus Christ. Same thing. God, Jesus Christ, interchangeable. It's her denial of the omniscience. How could you plot and scheme in front of the omniscient God? He's right overhead. Do you not think he has a good surveillance system? He does. This is the sin of Miriam and Gehazi, among others. We have law and grace with Gehazi. We have eliminating the mediator with Miriam and Aaron as well. But this one is first. We bring disgrace to ourselves when we have any trace of this sin in us, the sin of denying the omniscience of Jesus Christ. If you deny the omniscience of Jesus Christ, you have disgraced yourself, and God will spit in your face, in our face, in mine. If you deny that, Jesus Christ knows all things. That's the theme of the Gospel of John. Jesus Christ knowing all thoughts of all men. Jesus Christ knowing that the Father had given all things in His hands. John 13:3. Jesus Christ therefore knowing all things. John 18:4. Jesus Christ knowing that all things were now accomplished. John 19:28. Jesus Christ knowing all things is the theme of the Gospel of John. The omniscience of Christ constantly gone over and over and over. You disgrace yourself. Sandals are thrown at you. When I go to these movies, I want to get up and throw shoes and spit at the theater screen. It's disgraceful. It's shameful.
There are no secrets. You and I and we do not have any secrets. Why would we think that? What's wrong with us? We disgrace ourselves. But let me go back. Any thought, any position that says Jesus Christ is in any way unknowing is a disgrace. And you get spit at. You get hit with a shoe. Don't do it. Any thought. Anything. You think Jesus Christ was scared to be executed? Think he's afraid? Think he doesn't know what Satan's up to? When he says, "Who touched me?" He doesn't know. That is a disgrace. Consider that next time you go to one of these crucifixion movies. People ask me all the time. People that used to come here and don't come here anymore because I probably annoyed them. That's my job, annoying somebody every Sunday. Yes, you're doing very well. How intuitive. They don't come anymore because I told them exactly this off to the side. They loved that recent movie. They told me that I had to see it. They told me they'd give me a copy of it. They told me that it's so important. And I told them, I can't. It's a disgrace. I don't care how it made you feel. It implies that Jesus Christ does not know all things. It is a disgrace. And I get spit on enough, I didn't need more. Let's rise and be dismissed.